is the College Game Day Podcast. I'm guest hosting today. This is Pete Thamel here with Jeff Borizzello. We were side by side courtside in Boston for the UConn obliteration on Saturday night. And we're here to give the Game Day listeners a little bit of a Final Four breakdown. And I guess, Jeff, like, it's always sort of a dizzying run, I think, to this point. Have you now that we have four teams in the Final Four here, caught your breath a little bit and digested it?
I thought I caught my breath, and then NC State and DJ Burns won again. And now it's just, I have to restart. I have to catch my breath again after that. I mean, had Duke won and it was UConn, Alabama, Duke and Purdue. Okay. That's a solid Final Four. It's a, mm-hmm. you know, maybe a little bit of a surprise, but not crazy. Now you're throwing an 11 seed in it, a team that needed to win the ACC tournament to get in the tournament. And, you know, that throws a wrinkle into the entire Final Four, but it adds a little bit of juice to it.
So let's go through the matrix. I saw you retweeted tonight. Lavelle Motan, the head coach at NC Central, had a great tweet with the missed free throw from the ACC tournament Virginia game. Correct?
Yep. Yeah.
If that free throw was made, that, you know, this wouldn't happen. Pat Kelly, like, what all different variables could have happened if NC State had anonymously bowed out of the ACC tournament they were expected to do and should have done.
Right. I mean, you can go back further than that. First, the opening round, their opening game of the ACC tournament, they were losing to Louisville at halftime. Like, Kevin Keats could have been 20 minutes from not only the season being over, he could have been fired. And then, again, I mean, they won 5 games in 5 days, a Virginia game, Virginia choosing not to foul after the missed free throw. Again, and there was an 85% free throw shooter on the line to clinch the game for Virginia. Didn't make it. NC State forces overtime and then wins and then beats Carolina in the title game. I mean, it's an incredible story. You know, it's the ghost of Jim Valvano is carrying them along. I mean, DJ Burns is just an incredible story on his own. They're the 6th 11 seed to make the Final Four. And again, I mean, they're going to be huge underdogs to Purdue, but I don't know. There's something about this team. There's something about DJ Burns. He's unstoppable. All of a sudden he's, I don't know if he's ever been unstoppable at all in his college career, his long college career at 3 schools now. And he has just turned it up in the last 20 days, 9 straight elimination games. And he's playing like one of the most dominant big men we've seen all season.
So we could do a whole like what if podcast on that. But do what I see is, who is NC State's coach if Kevin Keats gets fired, you know, the Thursday of conference tournament week, as was somewhat expected?
Yeah, I would have gone probably Pat Kelsey.
Pat Kelsey, yeah.
And then again, that's a domino for Louisville. Who knows what happens there? I mean, their search was drawn out enough already. But I mean, yeah, you're right. The what ifs, the dominoes, Virginia. You know, if they win that game, are they even in the play-in game? It's just, you know, there's so many ramifications just from NC State's run alone. That them still being alive is just, it's just a fascinating deal.
Yeah, I think on paper, obviously, like the Final Four would have been, you know, had more juice with Duke, as you mentioned, right? But like, it's always good to have an interloper. Like, this event allows the interloper. Like, you don't want one in the college football playoff title game, like TCU. That was not good for business, right? That was just like, whoa. But I think the Final Four can afford that. And at no point, like at this point, like, you can just not say, oh, and they're going to lose now with NC State, right? Like,
we've been saying it for probably six games, nine games now. I mean, it's just, again, they're going to be probably, I don't know what the line is, probably like 11 and a half, 12 and a half, something like that. But, you know, I doubt anybody's completely writing them off. I mean, they completely outplayed Duke, and it wasn't, you know, a fluke game. I mean, the second half, they were just unbelievable. I mean, Duke couldn't make shots, and NC State made everything. And it's just an unorthodox way of playing with Burns and surrounding him with shooters. And I don't know. It's just, it's Kevin Keats. I mean, he's, you know, he was coaching high school basketball not too long ago, and he's worked his way up, and now he's in the Final Four. And
three of these guys were coaching high school basketball not too long ago.
That's a good point. And like you said, it's Duke would have been, you know, it would have been a more classic Final Four, but NC State, it's fun. I mean, and I think that if you're a neutral fan going to the Final Four, I think they're going to have a lot of that crowd on their side.
Their women are also going to the Final Four.
Yep.
Despite the mispainted, mismeasured free throw lines in Portland, just an all time blunder.
And the fact that they kept playing, unbelievable. Yeah, they agreed to just keep playing.
Yeah, no, that was an all time strange one. But as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh boy, this is, you know, this is like, to me, this is like 10 times worse than the weight room thing a couple years ago.
Yes, agreed.
Like, that was during COVID. Like, it wasn't, and you know, it wasn't a normal playing field. This is just like, what are we doing?
Like,
you know?
Full games went by without them noticing it.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. Yeah. Like, Yeah, that's all right. I got distracted. I'm going to add quick on a football note because we talked plenty about Boo Corrigan, the athletic director at NC State here. Hats off to him. He got a lot of flack in the wake of the college football playoff decision this year. He was the he obviously was the head of the committee, so he was the face that showed up every Tuesday and had to explain. It's one of the worst jobs in college sports to just get propped up there. Like you're basically like going to the dunk tank every week. And yeah, fans got pretty nasty and threatening with him, and it was a bad couple weeks. And again, no one deserves that type of vitriol for doing their job. So I saw Boo on the court after the ACC tournament on television. He was crying openly. So I can't even imagine what he's feeling like today. I don't know which game he was at or anything like that, but like what a remarkable emotional swing for that school, for that place. Boo Corrigan's one of the good guys. So anyway, just wanted to note that like NC State has always sort of been mired in the upper middle class. And this is what a breakthrough for their university, just to have, this stage for a week. They're the center of the universe, which is pretty cool in hoops. The other place that's the center of the universe is Storrs, Connecticut, which is basically a cow patch off of I-84. You've been there many times like I have, and there are many times when I'm driving down that road and being like, this is it. This is where like a basketball juggernaut has existed for the last generation. And we were witness to the 30-0 run, which if it's not unprecedented, somebody probably if it was unprecedented. If there was precedent to that, somebody probably would have dug it up by now, I think, this late in the NCAA tournament for someone to score 30 unanswered points. It was just insane. Jeff, your thoughts watching the UConn evisceration of a pretty good Illinois team?
Yeah, I mean, just the stats on their own are just kind of eye-popping. I mean, they've trailed for 28 seconds total in the NCAA tournament. They've won 10 straight tournament games by double digits, the first team ever to do that. I mean, they just won the Elite Eight and Sweet 16 games by a combined 55 points. That just doesn't happen. And it's the fact they did it. I mean, San Diego State came in with a top 10 nationally ranked defense, and then UConn went out and I think it was San Diego State's worst defensive performance since maybe 2015. And then Illinois came in with the number two offense in the country, and UConn held them to their worst offensive performance since 2019. Those might be flipped, but I know it's one's 2015, one's 2019. So I mean, it was just remarkable. I mean, they were able to do it in two different ways. And there was a little stretch in the Illinois game, kind of end of the first half. Illinois tied it up with I think it was minute 40 left or so. UConn couldn't really make a shot, and Illinois got going just a little bit. Domask was kind of getting whatever he wanted. Backing down smaller guards, and you kind of thought, okay, is this the first time UConn's going to sweat? And then they score five straight to end the half, and then they score the first 25 to open the second half. And it just kind of became more unbelievable after every basket. And when was Illinois going to score again? It was just an onslaught like I don't know if I've ever seen before at this point in the NCAA tournament. 30-0 run is the biggest run UConn's had under Dan Hurley, period. And they've played some pretty bad teams in non-conference play, and they just did this in an Elite Eight game against the second best offense in the country that just won the Big Ten tournament. It was unbelievable, and watching the other Elite Eight games over the weekend, I mean, UConn is going to go into the Final Four as the overwhelmingly heavy favorite to go back to back.
Yeah, the early lines I saw, and we're taping this on Sunday night, was there'll be a double digit favorite against Alabama, somewhere around 11 and a half. The word that Dan Hurley used to describe Illinois was spooked. There were so many shots that Don McLean blocked at the rim that they were just kind of like scared to go up. Terrence Shannon got blocked a bunch of times. And again, this is one of the most like vicious scorers in the country. Right. He goes downhill. He attacks the rim. And he was like seeing ghosts behind him. I'm just curious, like that element here. We're going to talk a little bit. It's a big man Final Four, which is quite unusual. But just that element in what he did defensively, I thought was pretty remarkable.
I mean, his first 17 minutes on the floor, Illinois scored 4 points. Shannon ref just, there was that, and I know I mentioned to you during the game, early second half during that run of UConn, Shannon basically stopped at the free throw line. He refused to go closer to the rim. He was afraid of getting blocked. He just completely changed the game, and Illinois probably should have decided at some point, hey, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to shoot threes and either force him to come out and guard us, or he could stay by the rim and we'll have open threes. And that's sort of what they talked about. Illinois talked about on Friday going into the game. They said, okay, we have Coleman Hawkins. We can play five out. We're going to force them to adjust to us. And well, that, you know, that didn't quite happen. You know, in UConn, just, they didn't put Klingon on Coleman Hawkins. They put, you know, Cam Spencer and some other guys on him. And they said, Klingon, you're going to sit in the lane. And if Ty Rogers wants to shoot threes, he can. And otherwise, you're going to block everything. Credited with five blocks, probably one or two short of that. And the stat that just is 0 for 19. Illinois was 0 for 19 on field goal attempts contested by Klingon. They didn't make a single shot when he was contesting it. It's just, and again, this, it's not a, this wasn't a first round game against a 16 seed. This was Illinois, sure. Who, if had they won that game, hey, maybe they're going to be you know, they've already beaten Purdue this year. So, or at least they won the Big Ten tournament. So it's, I don't know. It was Klingon's performance, especially the way he played after the way he played against San Diego State when he wasn't great. I mean, Jaden Ledee kind of had his way with him early. Got into some foul trouble, and you know, that's, we'll talk about this down the line, but you know, that's maybe the concern against Edie. But I don't know if I've ever seen an interior defensive performance like he had against Illinois.
Yeah, in passing, Luke Goody, the reserve Illini forward, mentioned in the locker room, he was like, well, since there's no defensive 3 seconds, and it was sort of, yep, like there was no way for us to dislodge him from that anchor down there. And yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see, because Alabama, and we didn't see much of that game because we were obviously working after our early game at Boston. They do not have a traditional big, correct? That's just sort of antithetical to the way they play anyway, correct?
They shoot a million threes, and they play super fast.
Now, they will spread the floor and shoot it. I think they'll stick to the plan better than Illinois did. But yeah, it could be another showcase opportunity for Klingon there.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
One of the things that I dug up from my column that I thought was pretty interesting from the macro is Dan Hurley, the sort of endearingly caustic New Jersey bile filled, deprecating to the point of like incessant smirking, could end up joining some rare air pretty quickly this weekend. There are only two coaches who have won two national titles on the floor, because one of Rick Pitino's doesn't count. Bill Self is the other one. And all of a sudden, Dan Hurley, who going into last tournament kind of needed to win a couple games, mm-hmm, because
I don't want a tournament game. Yes, as coach of UConn.
He brought up, I thought it was very classic him that he brought up Teddy Allen. New Mexico State is a 12, beats UConn as a 5. Teddy Allen goes for 37. That game was like a rock fight, as Dan Hurley called it. But they're knocked out of the tournament in the first round for the second straight year. And look, UConn has higher standards than that, you know, and nobody knows that better than Hurley. So how do you think, Jeff, you're around that program a lot, living in the Northeast, how do you think they got from Teddy Allen to 10 straight 10-point NCAA tournament wins? Like, give me a snapshot of that development from the macro.
I think Hurley looked in the mirror and said, we can't win big in March playing the way we do. You know, he's kind of known for, even back to kind of his high school days, he was known for, we're going to play tougher, we're going to be gritty. And you know, they didn't mind rock fights. That was kind of, you know, his identity. And I think he said, we can't win playing this way. We're going to go out and we're going to build a team that has guards who can score, got guards who can shoot, you know, forwards that can shoot. And we're still going to kind of have that nastiness, that kind of us against the world mentality that he has instilled in his team every step along the way. And it's worked. I mean, they've recruited that way. They obviously have played that way. And I think the other thing is the way they've transformed their offense. It seems like most programs around the country, it's just kind of a lot of ball screen continuity offense. And UConn's kind of gone away from that a little bit and said, you know, we're going to do a lot of off-ball movement, off-ball screening, get guys open for threes. And, you know, coaches that have played them say it's the hardest offense to prepare for, because they'll run the same play for different guys in different spots, and you just don't really know what's coming. And they have a deep playbook. And, you know, a lot of coaches say, oh, you know, we don't have time to you know, run all these sets and kind of get our guys to memorize all these plays. And Hurley and his staff said, you know, we're going to do this. and they run stuff, and it's just unbelievable sets. When you watch them, it's really hard to prepare for. It's really hard to prepare for on short notice, especially. And sure. So I think Hurley's ability to adapt and realize, hey, what we're doing is not working, I think that's been a huge part of their turnaround.
Yeah, Chester Frazier, the Illinois assistant and former great player there, had the scout for that game, and he called their playbook encyclopedic. He just said there were so many plays that, like, you can't just be like, oh, we really need to stop scissors, because and all those plays have different options off them. And I think when you play sort of the space pace game with reading and reacting, that's the hard part about stopping it, is that if you're in a state of constant movement and you're reacting to what the defense does, it makes everything much more difficult.
Yeah. And you know, at the end of the day, they can also say, hey, we're going to throw into our 7'2" top five pick center. And, you know, he wasn't great against San Diego State, like I said, but he was dominant against Illinois with his back to the basket. And they have an All-American point guard in Tristan Newton. Like, they have guys that when plays break down, they could say, okay, go make a play, and they do it. It's really remarkable what they're doing offensively. And now, after they're showing against Illinois, they're top five defense now, too. So that toughness that Hurley wants, they still have that edge. And the other part is, and it's kind of fascinating to me, they don't seem to play with any sort of weight of anything. I mean, you know, they're going for the first repeat since Florida in 06-07, and I don't know if you'd be able to tell as an outsider. They don't seem to have any sort of pressure on them, and they've talked about that it's just sort of, you know, we're going to play our game. You know, Newton, after the 30-0 run, and he said, we shot 33%, we were up by five in the first half. We know we're not going to shoot 33% for the game, and once our offense starts scoring points, the game's over. And I just think that they have an incredible level of confidence that they're playing with right now. And, you know, the staff prepares them well, and then they go out and execute it really well. And again, they just have that kind of chip on their shoulder, that toughness that Hurley has kind of instilled in them.
You did a story last week, Jeff, about the difficulty of repeating, and talked to a slew of people, be it Billy Donovan, the last coach to repeat, or guys who've tried and failed, Jay Wright, Scott Drew. What was one takeaway for that you have now, looking back on that story a few days later, that surprised you or stood out to you at the difficulty of doing what UConn is on the cusp of doing here?
Well, I think part of it was Hurley reached out to coaches that had tried to do it. I mean, he said he talked to Billy Donovan. He reached out to Tom Izzo. He reached out to people that had either done it or tried to do it and couldn't. And he just kind of wanted to get a feel for hey, what'd you guys do? And Billy Donovan told me, he said, the first thing you have to do is separate it. You know, you're not defending anything. That championship is over. That doesn't get you a single point in any game next year. And again, that's harder to do than just to tell your team, hey, forget about it. We didn't win that championship. And they seem to kind of listen, and they seem to understand, hey, you know, that championship is nothing. You know, we need to go out and do it again. And Jay Wright said something that I thought was interesting, and kind of Scott Drew alluded to this too, is that you're taking everyone's best shot every single game. Mm-hmm. And the fatigue of that, the mental fatigue of, hey, we're everyone's Super Bowl, and we have to go out every single game and be everyone's Super Bowl. And it just kind of weighs on you after a while. Again, that's something that it doesn't seem like that has really impacted UConn. I mean, they're blowing teams out. I think they've had one single digit game in the last, you know, 6 weeks or something like that. And it was the win over St. John's at the Garden. And I think they've also, I'm not going to say they're fortunate, but they had a ton of injuries early, and knock on wood, that hasn't happened recently for them. And so they've kind of gotten past that, and because of that, they got some role players that kind of stepped up and know their role now. You know, I mean, we saw Samson Johnson had a pretty good game off the bench. Hassan Diar has played really well. Guys got a lot of experience when Castle was hurt and Klingon was hurt. Cam Spencer had a little ankle thing at some point. Caravan was hurt at some point. So they've just, the mental fatigue, the depth, it doesn't seem to be impacting them like it did to Baylor and Villanova and teams like that.
Last question on UConn before this turns into the No Escalators podcast.
Great reference. Look at you.
I'm curious if you can put in our context, because look, if you know, a lot of Final Four people watch the Final Four are casual fans, right? And we just mentioned Florida, the last team to repeat. They had five starters back and rolled it again, mm-hmm. and did it, which is impressive and hard to do. Give us a snapshot, maybe, for people who aren't grinding out that UConn UNH game in New Hampshire, just of what was lost and how it was replaced. And I think the important part, I guess, Jeff, is through the prism of modern college basketball, right? Like, it's like everybody's, you know, everything's every roster is a slot machine, basically. And you have to like pull the handle and hope it stops right in a lot of ways. Just put into context how they reconstructed this thing. And that's really hard to do to get back here.
Yeah. I mean, Jordan Hawkins left. first round pick. Andre Jackson left. He was drafted in Adama Sanogo, last year's NCAA tournament most outstanding player, but also left. And now he's playing professionally also. I mean, Naheem Helene left. He transferred. So they've had guys. I mean, they had, I think, five players leave, including three starters.
Calcaterra, too, maybe?
Yep. He was another one. Joey Calcaterra, yeah. And Hurley, I mean, he had Donovan Clingan waiting in the wings to replace Sanogo. But again, I mean, that's a change. I mean, they play a lot differently. When Sanogo wasn't as – I mean, he was incredible back to the basket, was probably better than Clingan in that respect, but he was not nearly as dominant defensively. So they had to change the way they played a little bit there. They brought in Stephon Castle, who was a top 10 recruit, but he came in with reputation as a scorer, kind of a point forward, got a lot of size. He's developed into an elite defender, kind of a one-on-one stopper like Andre Jackson was for them last year. And you know, he dominated Boo Booey in the Northwestern game. He helped hold Terrence Shannon, as you mentioned, a 2-for-12, I think it was, from the floor. He'll probably guard Mark Sears in the Alabama game. And then the X factor in all this was Cam Spencer. And they badly wanted a shooter, a starting caliber guard from the portal. Initially, they wanted Nick Timberlake, transfer from Towson, and Kansas ended up getting him. And so they had a pivot.
Pride of Massachusetts, by the way.
Right. And they had a pivot. Cam Spencer becomes available, enters the portal pretty late from Rutgers, and UConn gets him. And now, if they get Timberlake, I don't know if we're having this conversation. He kind of had a pretty poor year at Kansas. And so kind of a sliding doors moment for them right there in terms of getting Cam Spencer, who has been terrific. Maybe not putting up as, you know, big of numbers as some of the other transfers, but, you know, UConn coaching staff will say, you know, he might be our most important player.
He's like a pest.
Yes.
Like, he's just kind of everywhere. Loose balls, in the lane, he's efficient.
He's kind of the heart and soul of the team. And, you know, he's the guy that's talking to the opponent when they're going on a run. And he's been just incredibly crucial for them. And so that was a huge key, getting him late and immediately slotting him into the lineup. And like you said, other teams have gotten guys out of the portal and brought in freshmen, and it doesn't click like this. And UConn basically clicked from day one. They've only lost one game at full strength. And so it didn't really take long for Hurley to piece this thing together and get it rolling.
All right. Well, we're going to roll to, we were texting before the podcast. We kind of agreed that the NC State story, the Purdue story, were like tied for like second best of UConn's dominance. And the repeat is obviously going to be the biggest story in college sports until they tip off Saturday night in Phoenix. But I think the NC State does have a little gold dust magic, right? A little ghost of Jimmy V, as you said. But the Matt Painter story is like sincere and sweet because we all have seen them fail on big stages. I was in Philly the night that that they lost to St. Peter's. But that lottery pick was terrible that night. Ivy, I mean, he was like, mm-hmm. he was awful. Like that guy should never have played that. It just a lot of things have to happen for you to lose right. those types of games over and over. Do you think there will just be an outpouring of support and goodwill for Matt Painter this week? Just at Purdue finally making the Final Four for the first time since 1980.
As long as you don't look at certain segments of Twitter, yes. The segment of Twitter that thinks Zach Edey is just big and gets way too many foul calls. So if you ignore that part of Twitter, then yes. I think a lot of coaches around the country are probably pretty happy for Matt Painter. He's been through a lot. You mentioned the St. Peter's loss. Obviously, the loss, I mean, they were the second Virginia, and now they're trying to kind of pull off that turnaround after last season. So it's they kind of developed that reputation for, hey, we can't pick them to do it until they do it. And now they finally got over the hump and got into the Final Four. And they did it in an incredible game. You know,
great game.
Edey and Dalton Connect were the two best players in the country all season. You know, Edey had a pretty sizable lead for the, you know, National Player of the Year award. But Connect was incredible. Best transfer in the country by far. And they put on an absolute show. I mean, Edey had 40. Connect had 37. But Edey just got a little bit more help when it mattered. Guys made, Lance Jones made a couple of big shots. Lawyer made a couple of big shots. And Tennessee just didn't get much outside of Connect. And their big guys really, really struggled. So maybe the best kind of duel we've seen all tournament. And I think there's some stats that show maybe the best duel in the last however many 30 years of the NCAA tournament.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think there was a stat that it's the first time ever that two players, one from each team, have accounted for more than 50% of their team's points. So it's kind of a historic scoring battle that went on between those two. And, I think the Edey story is, and again, I mean, there are people that still, oh, he's just big, he's 7'4", blah, blah, blah. He's come a long way.
Sure.
I mean, he was a hockey and baseball player growing up, and he bailed on on baseball because the umpires couldn't figure out how to call balls and strikes because he was too big. And so he pivoted to basketball, and obviously the rest is history. But he's come, you know, he's developing. At this point last year, it was, I mean, 16-1 loss aside, he was not getting drafted. Why he came back. Yeah, that's why he came back to school. And now, you know, he's kind of a borderline lottery pick. You know, he's gotten better.
You think he'd go that high, huh? You think he's a top 20 pick?
I think he could. I think he, because at that point in the draft, I think that there are, I mean, NBA scouts will say it's kind of hard to see him not sticking around in the NBA for 7 years. And, you know, at that point in the draft, you're probably a, you know, bottom tier playoff team. And that is good enough for you, I think. And so I do think that there are a lot of teams that will take him in that area. And he's really come a long way, especially defensively. He's more mobile than he was a couple of years ago. He's better at the rim than he was a couple of years ago. He's got better hands. He's just every little facet of his game has improved. And, you know, I think we saw today, I mean, Tennessee threw everything at him, three bigs and fouls and everything. And he just dominated time and time again. And it's, you know, we're looking ahead. Him versus Klingon would be an incredible one-on-one matchup, but him versus DJ Burns that he has to go through the magical breakout run of DJ Burns first.
I think it's a good point on Edie, because there's sort of been a bit of a paradigm shift, I feel like, for NBA front offices of, if you can't get an elite talent in the top 15, you draft an older guy because you know what you're getting and he can help you. And I think about, like, the Celtics' third big is the kid from Utah State. Is it Nemus?
Yep.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, played like, in 2019, 2018, something like that. Yes. Yeah.
And like, I just give it an example of like, he's a marginal 7 foot. Like, Zach Edey's probably better than him, you know, like in that, you know, where he is right now. That's no slight on him. But if you're picking from 20 to 30, you want rim protection and you want someone, you know, this isn't Taco Fall. This dude can move and he can run. And, you know, he can play a functional role on the fringe of an NBA rotation for a while to come. So
I think Kenny Smith might've said at halftime, one of the games, like, he can play, you know, he's probably not going to be an every game starter in the NBA, but he can go in, he can give you 7 minutes in each half and literally do everything you just said. He could protect the rim. He could score around the rim. He'll rebound, you know, maybe a foul or two. And he'll just be really big and really good for those 14 minutes, and that's fine. You know, he's a generationally dominant college player.
Oh,
and
yeah.
For me, it's just hard to see him not succeeding or having some level of success in the NBA.
Yeah. Now, he could probably go make a killing in Europe, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, he could go be, like, the best player over there. Skilled is he? Like, I've seen, you know, he passes the ball pretty well, I would say, right? Like, maybe not as well as, like, Klingon, who we just saw, who can kind of buzz it around a little bit. But he's become a pretty functionally skilled player, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's not really going to step out and shoot. I think he did make a three toward the end of the season, maybe the first of his career, I want to say.
Oh, wow.
But he's capable of catching it at the free throw line and kind of finding somebody. And he's really good passing out of double teams. Not as good as DJ Burns, who was just an incredible passer. Ooh. But he is good enough where if you're going to come at him with a double team, A, he's just bigger than you. He could just look over you and pass to somebody else. But he's got good enough vision. He doesn't really force things. And the other thing is he just gets – incredible position time and time again against anybody. You know, you talk to coaches in the Big Ten and everyone says, oh, we're going to front him, push him away from the rim, put him, you know, force him to his left. And they just say, yeah, good luck. You know, everyone's tried this stuff for 4 years. That hasn't worked. And so it's the way the refs kind of officiate him against Klingon, if that is the title game, or him against Burns too, that's going to be fascinating. Because again, I'm not one of those people that says, hey, he gets away with stuff. And, you know, but, you know, I think there was a part of the Illinois fan base yesterday that thought Klingon probably got away with a few fouls at the rim. Now, I don't think he did. It looked like he, you know, went straight up a few times, but he gets two fouls in the first 6 minutes against Edie, and suddenly they're going to Samson Johnson. It's an entirely different game. So how the refs kind of officiate him moving forward the next two games is going to be interesting to see.
Yeah. With the, you know, the big man Final Four, the throwback Final Four that we have, how the game is called, I think, is going to be in a lot of focus this week for like the hoops head types, you know, like, because NCAA tournament games tend to be called tighter, Jeff, correct? Because the officials all want to move on, so they don't want to miss fouls because it will cost them in their evaluation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the thing, or kind of the trope with Big Ten teams, is that, oh, it's officiated differently in the NCAA tournament. That's why Big Ten teams don't win. I don't know how true that is, the reason why the Big Ten teams don't win generally, but it is, you know, it's considerably tighter. You're supposed to get away with less in the tournament, especially in the Final Four, when, you know, all eyes in the country, all eyes in the sport are watching you.
Quick autopsy on Tennessee's season. They played well. I feel like that was one of those games that was a really good game for 38 minutes, and it didn't end great. So it might not be remembered as a classic, but I thought it was a really fun back and forth, you know, two superstars going at it. You know, Rick Barnes obviously comes up short of the Final Four, but has a pretty darn good season. How do you think this Tennessee team gets remembered, Jeff?
I think it's going to be remembered for Dalton Knecht for the most part. Again, he was incredible all season. Just the way he shot the ball, the way he, from day one, I mean, I think it was Michigan State they played in the preseason, an exhibition game, and he was immediately the best player on the floor. And that doesn't generally happen for guys from Northern Colorado or transfers in general. And he just hit the ground running and was just the best player in every single game they played until they played Purdue. And you know, Edie went for 40 on him.
Where does he get drafted, Jeff?
Lottery. I mean, he's 6'6". He's just a terrific shooter. He can get his own shot off the bounce. I do find it interesting that after today's loss, after Sunday night's loss, Tennessee was 4-4 in games he scored over 30 points. And, you know, we briefly mentioned at the beginning, he just didn't get enough help. You know, Edie got help and Connect didn't. And it seems like, especially down the stretch of the season, Tennessee kind of waited for him to do stuff and, and hope that it'd be enough to carry them. And it just wasn't a lot of the time. But I think that this team, I mean, Connect is a senior, Vescovy's a senior, and James is a senior. The rest of the guys, for the most part, can come back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think Barnes is going to hit the portal and hopefully strike gold again with a Connect-type player. But the other part is the past couple years, they've been fairly anemic offensively, and they've been just a grinded-out defensive team. You know, I'm not going to say that they transformed the way that Hurley has transformed UConn, but I think they played a lot more open. A lot of that had to do with Connect, just giving them a little bit, just a huge plus on the offensive end of the floor. But I think Barnes realizes, hey, to win in March, you got to be able to score the ball. And they were still really good defensively, and I think they're going to continue to be. But I think that he's going to go into the portal and say, hey, we got to get some more scorers and replace Connect and just kind of play the way that we did this year. And I think Tennessee's going to kind of look to play that more faster paced, more perimeter shooting, more offensive style.
Who do you think would be a better dancer, DJ Burns or you, at a club?
Burns, man. I mean, like, did you see it? I think it was the second half during the review. He was kind of like, he was getting after on the court.
Didn't stop dancing. I'll never forget that. Like, when I think about this tournament 10 years around, I'm just thinking about him at the free throw line, between free throws, just kind of moving and going. And
I put my money on him.
Elite Eight today.
Yeah, I put my money on him. I put my money on him out dancing me. If we had a dance battle,
how's your footwork? Is it as good as his?
When I was his age, maybe. Okay. I don't know about anymore. I mean, I'm old and weathered now. maybe in my prime, I could give him a run for his money.
His game is fascinating
now. Like, we've seen him play a lot the last few weeks. What have they played now? Nine games
in 20 days.
So first of all, he's lefty, so everything's a little bit cooler, right? It just looks a little different and it's a little good. But his touch, man, like, that's got to be a rare 1% kind of touch, especially passing, right?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is that, you know, just the fact that he's a lefty makes him unique to guard. I mean, most guys are just, you force a guy left and he's going to struggle. Now it's just kind of everything's flipped around, but we've seen he's thrown in some, you know, the jump hooks and up and unders, and you know, like you mentioned, the footwork is just fantastic back to the basket. And then the passing, he's made some passes that, especially in the Marquette game when he kind of struggled to score around the rim and dealt a little bit of foul trouble, you know, he was just finding guys that I didn't see how he thought they were open, and they got there with not intercepted, not touched, not anything, got there on a fly in shooting position. Perfect pass. He had 7 assists against Marquette in that game. And it's the vision, the passing. And you would think that, you know, someone like Filipowski for Duke would be able to kind of take him away from the basket defensively and kind of go off the dribble or make shots and really kind of give him problems. And that didn't happen. And the same thing with Marquette. Osa Iguodaro, I kind of thought the same thing. Inside, outside guys that could bring him away from the basket, beat him on his, you know, just kind of test his foot speed. You know, he's listed at 275. That might be, you know, being nice to him. Like, he's not incredibly quick laterally, and he's been able to hold his own against quicker, bigger guy, quicker 5 men and guys that could take him outside. And he's been going the other way and just kind of putting them, you know, kind of whatever he wants to do to them on the offensive end, he does. And 29 against Duke, 24 against Oakland, 16 against Texas Tech, 20 against Baycott in the ACC title game. He's doing this against real, you know, legitimate big men consistently. And again, I'm not going to count him out against Edie. He's going to be at a 7-inch height disadvantage, but with that passing ability and that footwork, he's going to be able to find ways to score and get his teammates points.
So you mentioned Filipowski. He had
I drank sour milk face for most of the second half. Didn't like the way some things were called. Didn't like the way the few things went. Didn't shoot it particularly well. Everything kind of went sideways for him. Again, great player. He'll be a top 10 pick too, I would assume, right? Right around
lottery
there.
Pick, yeah.
Yeah. I use Filipowski as a window into Duke. You're two under John Shire. And again, they got to the Elite Eight, right? Like, that's not – it's hard to have a bad season and get to the Elite Eight. But it seemed like one of those – if this is a college football game, the fans would be, like, want to fire the offensive coordinator. They were just, like, stagnant in that – well, the whole game, really. But it felt like they were just stuck in neutral that first part of the second half. And they really weren't in the game for the last 10 minutes. Like, they're threatening to come back way. I don't know. I'm curious. Roster construction is probably the thing you could probably speak to best. What do you think about that and where they go from here, Jeff?
Well, they were preseason Final Four. You know, that was kind of their expectations going into the year. I think there were two in the AP poll, if I'm not mistaken. So getting to Phoenix was kind of the expectation. Going into the tournament, that wasn't the case. But when you're playing an 11 seed from your own conference in the Elite Eight, now it's kind of, okay, well, they should have made it. But there were some just kind of issues with the way the roster was constructed. Now, I think Shire kind of knew that going into the year, but Mark Mitchell just was not, they didn't really have a true wing. I mean, Jared McCain came on and was just, you know, but he's 6'3". It's not, they didn't have that kind of explosive 6'6", 6'7". Right. Like, they didn't have a Dalton Kinect.
Teams have four slashers usually.
Right. And so, I mean, Tyrese Proctor, I don't think took the step forward that most people thought. I mean, people thought he was kind of a lottery pick, first round talent going into the year, and he didn't make a shot, if I'm not mistaken, against NC State on Sunday. So, you know, Jeremy Roach was solid, but they didn't have that real dynamic guy that could say, okay, when there's five on the shot clock, can you go get a basket? McCain, elite shooter, not someone that you're going to say, okay, he's going to break a guy down off the bounce time and time again. And so I think that, you know, there were some issues with the way the roster was constructed. And I do think Duke tried to go into the portal late in the cycle last year and maybe get an additional score or two, and just couldn't do it. And I think the injury to Caleb Foster kind of took a little bit of that away. The freshman, top 30 recruit, 6'5", he can kind of fill a little bit of that role. But now everyone looks forward, and now the Cooper Flag era begins. And, you know, I do wonder if he's thinking, hey, if I had gone to UConn, they can go for three in a row.
Wow. That's at Jeff Borzello on Twitter. Feel free to send your thoughts.
It's a thought. But
he's from Maine. That's just a short drive down, you know, for all his people.
And I think he'll cover up for a lot of deficiencies next year. They do have the number one recruiting class coming in. And so Shire will kind of look to win the way that, you know, Calipari and Kay won 6-7 years ago with, you know, the best freshman in the country. And I do think he'll probably go into the portal, especially if, you know, Jeremy Roach leaves, and obviously Filipowski probably leaves, McCain could leave. So he's going to have to kind of bring in some reinforcements, but, you know, Cooper Flagg is going to be there, and he's going to be the center of attention, and he's going to be terrific. And he's going to have all the expectations of the world on his shoulders. And, you know, I think he'll live up to them. His two-way ability is just incredible. And, you know, we mentioned they don't have a lot of slashers. He will do that. He'll slash, he'll handle the ball, he'll pass, he'll shoot, he'll block shots, he'll do everything. So I think the future is very, very bright in Durham. You know, the message board posters might want to relax for maybe a year to see what Shire does with the freshman next season.
So for casual fans, Cooper Flagg is the number one recruit in the class of 2024. He reclassified, I believe, to go there. He's from Maine originally, won a state title as a freshman with his twin brother, correct?
Yes.
And then went to Montverde.
In terms of just pure ability as a prospect, he's the best to come through the high school ranks in a few years. Okay. He's just that dynamic and dominant. You know, he's an incredible shot blocker. And I think, you know, most of the highlights we see are him just, you know, grabbing the ball, running coast to coast and dunk on everyone. he was, I mean, Peach Jam, I think last summer, he was getting just triple doubles with regularity, you know, points, rebounds.
He's what, 6'9"?
Yeah.
So he should be the number one pick in the 2025 NBA draft. That's like, that would be a pretty big surprise if that doesn't happen.
Okay. He would have to disappoint at Duke probably to not be that, because I think people will take their chances on him being there. I'm trying to think of a comparison. I'm looking at ones on Google and I don't like any of them. Okay. I don't like Paul George. I don't like Jason Tatum. Franz Wagner seems like I think he's got a higher ceiling than Franz.
I hope so. No offense to old Franz, but
I mean, he's a fantastic player. And I think he is the type of player that will be an All-American, or at least a preseason All-American, from the day he steps on campus.
Yeah. He should be the best prospect in college basketball next year. Yes. And we don't know who else is going to be in the sport next year, but I would imagine he's going to be the best player. You know, in that.
That will be the expectation, yeah.
Anyway, before this devolves into a Duke recruiting podcast, we should turn the page to Alabama. Poor Alabama. Now, if Reese was hosting, we would have mentioned
that would have led the show earlier. That would have led the show, yeah.
Yes, not only because Reese went to Alabama, but Reese had them out of the tournament in the first round, too. So, yeah, and we, by the way, I just want to own this. Reese and I killed NC State's chances. We were both like, do not pick NC State. They just played every team that does that makes one of these runs. It's just happy to get there. Sputters out on Thursday afternoon. That was probably like my hottest take. My most defiant take on our going into the tournament podcast. It was just like, do not waste any like oxygen on NC State. They're just going to fold. So
I'm surprised Reese wrote off Alabama so quickly. I had them in Elite Eight. I had them.
You thought they were out of gas a little bit.
Yeah, I mean they
and they played poor going down the stretch. So there was
they were horrible.
And they're so like they were a hard team. I don't remember where I picked them. I didn't pick them to lose in the first round. I think I might have picked them in the Sweet 16. But the way they play does not set up well to win a lot of games in the tournament, right? Because
just a high variance way to play. And their defense has been atrocious for most of the year. I mean, there was, you know,
Well, they gave up 117 to Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned how poor they were playing. I think that they were something like 225 or 250 over the final 10 games or final six games of the season on the defensive end of the floor in terms of defensive efficiency. They were just not good. You know, they basically refused to guard anybody. I mean, they gave up 102 to Florida on March 15th, the last game they played before the tournament. They gave up 105 to Florida, I think, 10 days before that. And so they gave up 117 to Kentucky. They were giving up just insane scoring numbers to a lot of teams that you know, we're bounced from the tournament pretty quickly. And so it's understandable that you combine the variance of we're going to shoot a lot of three-pointers. If they go in, we'll be in the game. If they don't, we'll probably lose because of their defense. And against Clemson, we kind of saw that. First half, they weren't great. Clemson took a little bit of a lead early on. And then Alabama just, you know, Mark Sears particularly, just put barrage of threes. They made 16. And if you make 16 threes and you have some semblance of defense, you're going to win a lot of games. And that's kind of how they're going to have to play against UConn. We mentioned how tough it is to score and cling in. Alabama's going to have to just probably make 16 threes again. I mean, the last team to beat UConn was Creighton. They made 14. And so that seems to be at least, you know, one recipe of beating them. And if UConn shoots the way they did against Northwestern and Illinois, they only made three threes in both games. That's kind of the great equalizer in the sport. And, you know, if Alabama can make 12 or 13, then suddenly that's a huge advantage that UConn would have to make up solely on two-pointers and free throws. And so it is the type of team that if they get hot, could throw a scare into UConn. But because of how fast Alabama plays and how poor they've been defensively, I have a lot of concerns about how they're going to defend UConn, especially in transition.
Do you think Brant Nelson will
have the most famous mustache in American sports for the next week? He, to me, the North Dakota State transfer is one of the great stories, just the kind of guy who comes a little bit out of nowhere. And obviously people follow the SEC closely, know who he is, but, and he was high end in that Carolina game. Do you think his mustache gets some shine this week?
I think it has to. I think that's one of the kind of low key fun stories about Alabama. The other part is, and it's, you know, more common than you think in the portal era, but they're starting five. Mark Sears started his career at Ohio. Estrada played at Hofstra before Alabama. Yeah. Grant Nelson, North Dakota State. They have a guy that's out right now. Latrell Reitzel was at Fullerton before he came here. And Pringle, I think, started his career at Wofford before going JUCO. And so they are the face of the transfer portal era in college basketball.
And if they didn't play for Alabama,
like the most dominant brand of the last 15 years in college football, that would probably be a little more feel good story to,
yes, that's fair.
To them. But it is amazing just how, like, roster construction like that 5 years ago would have been unheard of. And just,
yeah, I mean, that would have been considered like going rogue. I mean, yes. You would have been the you know,
yes. That was like how New Mexico State built their rosters 5 years ago, not Alabama built their rosters 5 years ago.
Yeah. But Nate Oates has perfected it. He's figured out, hey, we're going to shoot a lot of threes on a lot of layups. Everything else in between that, don't do that. And it's worked. And it worked for him to a very lucrative contract extension earlier this month.
Yes. And they're defiant about the way they play that way.
Right.
Yes.
Like, it's, you know, it's.
It's in no mid-range twos, like, ever. Like, don't do it. Take a layup, take a three. Take a 25-foot three if you want, but don't take a pull-up jumper from 17 feet. Just don't do that. It's an inefficient shot, and you know there's they don't see it as a beneficial move on the offensive end.
Let's dive into the matchups both quick here, and then we'll send us on our way on our Sunday evening here. How the heck will Edie versus Burns play out?
I think NC State will kind of run a number of guys at him, sort of like they did against Filipowski. They had Diarra in there. Middlebrooks came in to have some fouls, but they're going to have to keep their guys out of foul trouble. I mean, we saw how when Burns and Diarra got in foul trouble early on, you know, there was a question, could they hang with Duke while their bigs were on the bench? They did. And then Filipowski got in foul trouble and Duke couldn't do the same thing with Ryan Young. So as we mentioned, foul trouble is going to be a huge thing. I do think Burns is going to probably try to operate in that. You know, we saw him in that kind of like the 12 to 14 foot along the baseline, probably try to draw a double team and then kick it out, draw Edie a little bit away from the rim. I mentioned how much better he's gotten defensively. He's still not, you know, he's not clinging level mobile on the defensive end. So if you can bring him away and kind of open up driving lanes, but they're going to have to make threes. And they've done that. They kind of changed their, not only has Burns had a breakout kind of few weeks, but Kevin Keats put more shooters on the floor and said, we're going to spread it out and make shots. And again, they're going to have to do that against Purdue. I don't see them. I can't predict them to win. But again, I mean, I wouldn't have predicted them to beat Duke. I wouldn't have predicted them to beat Texas Tech or win the ACC tournament or beat Marquette. And again, I mean, they're outplaying these teams. I mean, they handled Marquette by double digit. That game was felt kind of over. I mean, after you know a few minutes of the game, the Duke game was, they ran them out of the gym in the second half. So they're playing just incredibly well. And you know, Purdue, as good as they've been, has fallen victim to teams that they should beat. I mean, their losses this season, I think they're unbeaten against top 25 teams, or they lost to Northwestern, Ohio State, Nebraska, and Wisconsin. Like, those are four teams they should have beat. And they should beat NC State. But again, it's the ghost of Jim Valvano, the DJ Burns magic, the Kevin Keats magic, the whatever you want, the missed free throw in the Virginia game. Something is happening for NC State. So I don't want to count them out, but I will lean Purdue.
So as underdog game plans go, I would imagine Alabama's is not going to be radically different.
No, I think they're going to kind of stick to what they do. It's going to be, we're going to shoot a bunch of threes. We're going to play really fast. And again, I mean, Illinois said, hey, we're going to bring Klingon out. I think Alabama will actually do that. I don't know if they're going to be capable of guarding Klingon at the other end. They got a really good game out of their freshman, Jaron Stevenson, against Clemson. Can he do that twice in a row? Can Pringle play well? Can Grant Nelson and his mustache play well? They have a lot of things that need to go right for them, but the biggest thing will be making shots from three. And again, Stephon Castle, I mentioned how good he was. He's been defensively. If he can lock up Mark Sears like he did Bowie and Shannon, I find it hard to believe that Alabama's going to score enough to beat UConn.
Yeah. Castle's an impressive athlete, seeing him in person twice here. I mean, he's just like, he could be like a nickel corner in the NFL. He's got like a stoutness to him and a build and a burst that is really, really impressive. Let me ask you this. For our hardcore college basketball fans, who are the three best players in the transfer portal right now for all the forlorn fan bases dreaming of next year and roster revamping? Who are the standouts in the portal? I saw you refreshing the portal diligently for four straight days in Boston.
I never leave it. AJ Storr, Wisconsin, started his career at St. John's, so he'll be going on his third school in 3 years, all Big Ten player. I would say he's the best. Stanford, and you and I have texted about this, they probably have four of the 30 best, 50 best guys in the portal, and they were fairly dreadful this season. But Maxime Reynaud is really good, skilled, French big man, so he's probably up there. And then I think you can kind of pick your favorite mid-major kind of stud. Terrence Edwards will be a guy that most people remember from how well he played against Wisconsin in the NCAA tournament. Yep, from JMU. He's in the portal. Danny Wolf, guy from Yale, all Ivy League player. There's a lot of, I mean, if you were a all-conference player at a low major or mid-major school, chances are you're in the portal right now. And so you can kind of take your pick of your favorite, Summit League player of the year type of player, who, by the way, Zeke Mayo is in there also. You can pick your favorite, and that's probably a top five transfer as well.
All right, we're in a rapid fire to
the
end
here. The Pat Kelsey hire at Louisville has probably been the defining hire of the cycle here. What's your gut reaction to how that will go?
I like it. I think he's just what they need. I think Louisville needed someone who was going to bring some energy, kind of reunite the fan base. We've seen, on social media when he was at Charleston, he's going around campus and, talking to students and, doing selfies and videos, things like that. That's what Louisville needs. They haven't really had that. I mean, Kenny Payne didn't really have that. Chris Mack is not that type of guy. And they need someone who's going to just kind of reignite that fan base. And I think he's going to win. I mean, he's won at two schools. He's been to the tournament. He plays with an identity. I do like the hire, even though it's kind of took him a long time to get there.
Isn't he a big rim hang guy? Aren't those the videos of Kelsey online?
Yes, dry fit polos and hanging on rims. And I think if your shoe falls off in practice, you like throw it into the stands. Yeah, he's got a lot of quirks.
He does have some inner fire, though. Like, he's going to back down to the dude 80 miles to the east. He's not going to flinch at ACC Blue Bloods, right? Like, Pat Kelsey has confidence in Pat Kelsey from the times I've been around him.
And that's why I thought, and we mentioned NC State before and how he might have been a logical pick there. I think he's going to go into the ACC and look around and say, I'll go toe-to-toe with pretty much anyone in this league right now. And he's probably going to bring, three or four of his guys from Charleston, so he'll have some sort of continuity. It's going to take I don't think he's going to go 25 wins this season, but I just have faith that he's going to kind of turn it around and kind of bring some wins back to Louisville.
All right, let's wrap up with fearless predictions. Jeff, who plays Monday night and who wins?
I'll go UConn-Purdue, and I'll go UConn over Purdue. That Kling and Edie matchup is going to be tremendous, but I just think UConn has a little bit more will offer more help and just has too many weapons. And again, they're just playing at an insane level right now. And if they win, then the discussion begins on where do they stack up in the greatest teams of the last however many years, maybe ever.
Yeah. No, that probably would have been a good question in our UConn discussion, but we'll have multiple podcasts before to index that. So let me ask this then, which semi is closer? Who holds it closer in the semi?
I will go. It's a good question. I'll go Purdue NC State. I just think at NC State's going to play slower. Everything goes through Burns pretty much. And I think they can kind of keep that score low. And then if Burns can have another incredible game and their shooters can make shots, they'll stay close. I think Purdue's obviously going to win, like I just said. But I think they have a better chance of keeping it close. I think Alabama's the pace they play at is going to play right into UConn's hands.
That's good. That's a good point. All right. Well, and then there were four. Jeff Borzello. Look forward to sitting next to you in Phoenix this week, and hopefully we'll have a good wrap up pod before we're said and done here. Thanks for joining us on the Game Day podcast.